So, in the two lectures that I gave last week, I attempted to introduce some of the very basic concepts of algebraic geometry, particularly the ones that are most useful in studying compactified string theory. And what I want to do in the two lectures this week is go further into some topics related to discussing the parameter spaces for, or moduli spaces for, Calabi-Yau manifolds and other algebra geometric objects that occur in string compactification, and discuss how those, when formulated in terms of algebraic geometry, how there are natural ways of adding things that correspond to the boundary of the parameter spaces, and try to discuss some of the issues that arise in approaching the study of limiting structures in string theory from this point of view of algebraic geometry. So, actually, although it's called canonical singularities, I won't actually get to canonical singularities until toward the end of today's lecture, per se. But I want to start with some general remarks again about the sort of problem that we're looking at. So, I described in the beginning of the first lecture last week a list of possible problems in geometry, which you arrive at by trying to solve equations of motion that come from some action that's relevant to string theory or to some low-energy supergravity approximation to string theory. And this led us to the study of Ricci flat metrics, or in particular, ones with a covariantly constant spinner. It led to wanting to know about Hermitian-Einstein metrics on certain bundles. And something which came up, at least briefly, in Robert Bryant's lectures, and which I didn't stress last time, but which is certainly part of this story, is the study of, in the world sheet theory, the study of minimum area surfaces. In what mathematicians call symplectic manifolds. So it's a slight generalization. So these minimum area surfaces, in fact, what I have in mind are what are called pseudo-holomorphic curves. And this is a slight generalization of just looking at holomorphic curves, in other words, Riemann surfaces, in Kähler manifolds. And it's one of the ingredients in working out conformal field theory to study that particular area functional and its extreme points. So finding the solutions to the equations of motion become mathematical problems that are geometric, but they have a flavor of analysis to them. You have to solve some partial differential equation, which is nonlinear, and there have been sort of fairly direct methods proposed for solving these things. There have been other kinds of geometric analyses which are closely tied to the structure of these partial differential equations. But in all three cases, there's some kind of translation into the language of algebraic geometry through an extension of this analogy that I mentioned between the constant, between representing the set of conformal classes of metrics on Riemann surfaces by, on the one hand, looking at the solution of the equation that asks for a constant curvature metric, or on the other hand, looking in this slightly more abstract way at the set of all possible complex structures on this manifold and identifying an isomorphism class of a complex structure with a conformal class of metrics. So that's the sort of translation which can be made in some form or another for all three of these problems. And when you do it, you start to get some handle. Let me back up for a second. So I described those translations. I didn't describe this one, but the translation becomes the theory, Kontsevich's theory of stable maps. To get this one translated into algebraic geometry. And what I want to describe today is the some approach to studying the sorts of singularities that can arise when you let the parameters in these equations approach some limiting values where the equations degenerate in some fashion. So just to mention something about some of the behaviors in limiting situations. Well, the first one, the Ricci-Flett metrics, we don't have a lot of general information about these metrics, and we don't know too much about what happens when these Ricci-Flett metrics degenerate. And in fact, it's our paucity of knowledge from the differential geometry point of view about these metrics which leads to the motivation for studying them in more detail from the algebraic geometry point of view. But let me just say that in one case, the case of K3 surfaces, it was worked out by R. Kobayashi and also by Cheng and Yao, that there are limits when you look around in the space of all, in the moduli space, the parameter space for all, as I mentioned last time, there's I can call them Ricci-Flett Kähler metrics if I choose a complex structure, although actually for describing the space of metrics, it's probably best not to do that. The parameter space for the actual metrics looks like this locally homogeneous space. But you have to subtract a certain set from the homogeneous space before you take the quotient. And this is actually the set of, this is the union of all the reflection hyperplanes. Of this discrete group. And so you might expect that having described what would have been a nice complete, metrically complete moduli space, except for the fact that you had to leave out these point Z, that there should be some way of understanding the limiting behavior of the metrics when you approach Z. Limiting metrics as you approach Z can always be described as local orbifold metrics. So there's for each point along Z, there's some specific topology. So X, if I start out with the K3 surface X, degenerates to some XZ, which is now, if I'm choosing a complex structure, it's a complex surface with singularities, so-called quotient singularities. And the reason I said local orbifold metrics there, let's see. There are some small and annoying terminological differences between math and physics. So let me just give a very brief history. There was a nice term called V-manifold back in the 50s, which got forgotten. It was replaced by a term called orbifold by Thurston in the early 70s. And I believe that that Thurston's notion of orbifold includes this local notion, where you only insist that the quotient that the manifold is locally described in terms of quotient singularities. However, when orbifolds were first studied in physics, a global quotient was intended by the term. And so when people talk about orbifolding a string theory, they really often talk about taking a global quotient. Here I'm back to the local situation, where the singularities, so this means that XZ has description in terms of coordinate charts, so it can be written as a union of a bunch of coordinate charts, and each U alpha takes the form C2 mod a stabilizer, G sub alpha, which is a finite group, and then they have to be patched together according to certain rules. But there's not an assertion that there's a global orbifold structure here. And then by local orbifold metric, I mean something which asymptotically looks like, well, not asymptotically, something which is induced by an honest metric on C2 in each of these coordinate charts. So the metric comes from C2. That creates singularities at the fixed points of G alpha downstairs, but those are singularities of a very precise type in terms of these holomorphic sort of quotient coordinates near the singular points, and those are the types of metrics that arise. And now you impose the Ricci-Flett condition on top of all that structure, and this is what you find for limiting metrics on K3 surfaces. So, for example, okay. So these are bad orbifolds.
So you're saying the curvature never blows up in this modulus. If all the singularities are just local orbifold type things and the curvature is bounded everywhere?
Away from the singularities, yes, that's right.
On the manifold, it's bounded as you're approaching.
Yeah, here's the problem, and I'll do this in more detail in a few minutes. I have a picture in which I have some, perhaps if I take a one parameter family approaching Z, I have a picture of a complex threefold in which has a smooth total space and which has a central fiber that has a singularity, even though the total space is smooth. Or I can represent it by some other means, perhaps after replacing the parameter T by the square root of T here, I can describe it as a family of manifolds, which is topologically trivial, diffeomorphically trivial. From this point of view, you would see curvature problems along the exceptional set of this quotient singularity. So this is a blow-up map of the sort that I'm actually getting ahead of myself. I'm going to do this in more detail later. But this is a blow-up map, and there are these two different ways of describing the limiting surface. And if you tried to represent it as a manifold, you would see the curvature blow up. If you look at this orbifold representative, then in some L2 sense, there's a limit of these metrics on the smooth manifolds approaching the metric on the other manifold.
Dave, it is true or isn't that on the C2, before you divide by the G alpha,
yes,
there is a smooth metric.
That's a smooth metric. There's a smooth metric on the C2.
So
that's my local form of the metric.
Blow up or anything like that,
that's correct. But if you then blew up the origin,
then you get
degeneracies, right? So if you're trying to think of what happens, fixing the K3 as a manifold, and you're trying to think what happens to the curvature as you approach this limiting place, then you'll see curvature singularities along an S2. But that, in this sort of correct interpretation of a limit, that S2 is contracted to a point, and at that near that point, the curvature is fine. So we know quite a bit about K3 surfaces. I'll talk about these singularities from a kind of more intrinsic or abstract point of view a little bit later. Let me just say, though, that I certainly wanted G alpha to be a finite subgroup of SU2, not just U2, in that description. Oh, and the example that I was going to give was that among the choices for XZ are good orbifolds, global quotients, including the famous Kummer surface, where I take a 4 torus, which has been given a complex structure, so it's C2 mod Z to the fourth, and then I let the Z2 here act on the complex coordinates. Well, it acts as minus 1. It doesn't matter whether it's complex or real coordinates. X is minus 1 on all the coordinates, and there are 16 fixed points for this action. And the metric, the limiting metric, is flat. So that's a very nice situation where we can actually describe the metrics explicitly. And in the early 80s, Topiwala showed that you can start from the flat Kummer metrics and deform in some reasonable way, and thereby describe other K3 metrics, at least for points that are near the Kummer locus within the entire moduli space, in some kind of expansion around this flat metric. So it gives an alternate and slightly more constructive proof of Yau's theorem in the K3 surface case. Okay, so this is one sort of limiting behavior, and although I've described it metrically, in fact, somehow embedded in my description was some algebraic geometry, which I'll come back to a little bit later. In the Hermitian-Einstein case, I don't want to say too much, let me just say the word instanton. So there are limiting metrics where the curvature gets concentrated at a point, and this sort of behavior is pretty well understood, both from the point of view of the physics of the situation and the point of view of the geometry. In this world sheet theory, in this theory of pseudo-holomorphic curves, there's the bubbling phenomenon. In which you have a limit of an embedded surface which sort of acquires a neck, and as you take a further and further limit, the neck actually closes off and you create a completely new component of the source of the map. So this interpretation of the limiting map is not completely obvious when you start to study the problem. When you start to study the problem with a fixed topology on the source space for the map, you notice some kind of singularity occurring here, but there's a very nice interpretation as a so-called bubble in which a two-sphere can bubble off. And there's a theorem called Gromov's compactness theorem, which describes how to compactify the space of all maps, pseudo-holomorphic curves in a manifold, by including appropriate types of bubbling maps where the topology of the source manifold has also changed. So I just wanted to give you the flavor of the kinds of answers that analysis produces before translating these things into algebraic geometry. So the difficulty with these examples, where the curvature was somehow blowing up when you kept the topology of the manifold fixed, was that the understanding that we have of them, for example, in this bubbling case or in this orbifold limiting metric case, involves somehow changing the manifold that we had started with. And once you allow an arbitrary change of the differentiable manifold, you've kind of fallen off the edge of the world somehow. There's just too much freedom. It's very hard to control the problem, and you need a lot of situation-specific insight to formulate a generalized problem that has a good solution. So Gromov's insight as to what was needed to compactify the space of pseudo-holomorphic curves helped one get a handle on that problem. This insight, which really comes from algebraic geometry, that the natural limiting structures ought to have quotient singularities, was necessary to get a handle on that problem. And here the insight came from physics and from the understanding that people had about singular solutions to the Hermitian-Einstein equation. In algebraic geometry, we're fortunate to have a collection of limiting behaviors sort of ready-made for us in algebraic geometry, and that's because algebraic geometry is not just a study of manifolds from the outset, but it's a study of complex subvarieties of a, say, complex projective space, or I'll be doing a lot of local things today, and I'll just work in CN, which may or may not be manifolds. So let me take, for example, that's not what I wanted to do. Let me take, for example, the set xy equals lambda sitting inside of C2, just to get started, or xy equals lambda z squared sitting inside of P2, thinking of P2 as now having homogeneous coordinates xyz squared. Thank you. With lambda a fixed complex number. So if lambda is not equal to 0, the solutions to this look like a nice conic of some kind. In these so-called affine coordinates where I set z equal to 1, this looks like a hyperbola. This kind of hyperbola. And then when lambda is equal to 0, this hyperbola degenerates in a familiar fashion to the union of the coordinate axes. So the nearby hyperbola, in this case, can be drawn in the same graph if you have colored chalk. And